Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. Almost every introduction I get now, I now say, is the second best introduction that I've ever gotten. One time when I was asked to give a presentation for the Holy See at the United Nations, the chair of the meeting introduced me as by saying, "We will now hear from the representative of the Holy Spirit." I thank them for the promotion, but it's one of those accidents which actually gets to the truth, because through our baptism and confirmation, we are all representatives of the Holy Spirit. And I have another UN story that I think sort of informs your work. My first day at the United Nations, I was sitting at the table, and I had the Holy See sign in front of me. And someone from the United Nations came up to me and introduced herself. She was with the yearbook, and that the Holy See had not filled out their form this year. And being the child of two reference librarians, I figured I could answer almost any question. So I said, "Oh, well, what do you need to know?" Of course, when I left the Holy See mission, they said, "Under no circumstances are you to talk." But but that was publicly. So I asked her, and she says, "Well, the first thing we need is we need to know what is the population of the Holy See." And I said, "Well, if you're talking about who lives on ground that counts as Vatican City, then it's probably around 1,000 or so. I know they have a supermarket and, you know, they have a little town there." I said, "But, you know, the Holy Father represents all Catholics, and that's about 1.3 billion. And if you count the communion of saints, then we're talking really big numbers, or at least we hope." I had already lost her. She had a glazed look, walked away. I was going to tell her just hoping that the communion of saints goes up by one the day after I die, but that's... It is a great pleasure to be here. I've been to the Association for Catholic Colleges and University Conferences many times, and they used to overlap. I think we took a weekend, and then you had the week. And we'd look at your sessions and your gathering and the fun you were having, and we felt very envious. You know, professors, we just like to be quoted. And so this is a great treat to be invited here to speak. And when you look at your program, I mean, yesterday you had Cardinal Sean. I think tomorrow you have Father James Martin, who is the second funniest Catholic, I think, in America. I think Stephen Colbert might be the first, but also all of our theology teachers might tie for first, too, but that's another issue. And then it closes with Brooks and Shields, and you know, one of my few regrets is that my parents didn't live to see that I was on the same piece of paper as Brooks and Shields. So you might be wondering, why did they bring an economist here? And then you thought back to your theological training about redemptive suffering. I often introduce myself as a Catholic economic hitman, because there are many economists, particularly ones who do consulting, who work for groups almost like lawyers. They make arguments, and often they try to talk people into doing things they don't want to do to the benefit of whoever they're working for. The most famous guy wrote a book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and how he convinced third world dictators to go heavily in debt to the benefit of the State Department. And my job has often been to work for the groups that can't afford economists, who need someone who could go through the other sides, the government or the real estate developers' numbers, their economic analysis, and see, you know, is this legit or are they trying to pull a fast one? And almost always they're trying to pull a fast one, and they can get away with it because there's almost never someone from the other side who has the training to go through and see, are they double counting benefits, et cetera. And so a lot of what I do for mostly for Catholic groups now, but for unions and other groups, is to try to argue for an evidence-based approach, that if you're making an economic argument, it has to have evidence behind it. So that'll be one of the themes that I hope to talk about today. Okay, that's... I used to tell Bill Gates joke, and technology has never worked for me since. Oh, there it is. So there's initial reaction against, particularly when I give presentations where they're all economists, against the idea that the church or religion or anyone has anything to contribute to economics, that economics is a hard science, ethics has no place. In fact, one of the few liberal economists that we all hear so often, Paul Krugman, two Fridays ago, wrote a column on inequality where he said economics is not a morality play. And if he's right, then your lobbying is just trying to say, well, please do this because it's the right thing to do, even though it's not the right thing to do economically. That we want equity at the expense of efficiency is how economists would look at it. But that's completely wrong. And Mr. Krugman should read a little history of economic thought. All the great economists were philosophers. I mean, Adam Smith, to start with. Economics started out as a branch of moral philosophy. And ethics play an important role throughout economics. So we will look at that, and then we will look at Catholic social thought and the ethical perspective that it gives, which I think adds value to understanding the economy, particularly on how the direction we want to move towards. What are the problems we need to solve? And then I will go over some of the problems we don't need to solve that have very much paralyzed Washington in the last 3 years. And then I'll look a little at some of the economic problems that are top of your agenda, and unfortunately we're not on the top of the agenda for the campaign, but hopefully we can get politicians working on. Okay, I always start with a quote from Louis XIII. Louis XIII started the Catholic social thought tradition with Rerum Novarum, or at least the modern tradition. I'll show you that it actually goes back to the beginning. And in it, this sort of a line that's buried, but I think it really gets to the heart of what people working on public policy issues, how they should be guided. And there's nothing more useful than to look at the world as it is, as the world as it really is, and at the same time look elsewhere for the remedies to its issues. So it's basically we want to look at an evidence-based analysis of our problems, but from the perspective of the Gospels, bringing the values of the Gospel, which particularly helps us to make choices. Now, a lot of economics is about institutions. The economy is made up of institutions. All of our actions are in institutions. There's almost nothing in economics where it's one person with another person without any institutions, such as the legal system and the laws, property rights, and those are all institutions. Yet economists like to explain everything as if it's only individuals acting completely outside of institutions. Now, and institutions have to be made, and they're made in many ways, and they evolve over time, and you just can't, you know, make them out of thin air, but they are made. They're made by people making choices. And you could have inclusive institutions, institutions designed to bring as many people in to participate as much as possible, or you can have exclusive institutions, which are designed usually by those with power to limit everyone else's access once they have captured a part of a market or a revenue stream or whatever it is that they get their income from. And so a lot of your work in the policy realm is really asking for more inclusive institutions and fighting exclusive institutions. So the economy is about choice. That's what every economist will tell you. It's about individual choices, and it's about public choices, collective choices, both as a firm, as an organization, and as communities and nations. All choice requires some criteria for choosing. So to say that ethics doesn't play a role in economics misses the point that all economic decisions are decisions. There are choices that are being made, and the criteria ultimately goes back to some sort of standard, some sort of ranking of priorities. Economics doesn't give you that. Economics doesn't tell you that this is the right thing to do. At its best, it will tell you, well, this is how much it would cost. These are some of the hidden costs, and we should know those. And these are maybe some of the benefits that we can measure. But they're not going to tell you that this is morally right or morally wrong. You don't get that from economics. John Henry Newman has an essay where he tells the economists, To answer these questions, you have to go to the higher disciplines of philosophy and theology. Economists have distanced themselves in the past 40 years from that, but that's what Catholic social thought brings in. It brings in ethical standards and criteria for evaluating the economy that help us to make choices. Now, there are two basic approaches to economics in terms of ethics. One is that people should follow their own individual self-interest. Milton Friedman once critiqued John F. Kennedy's "Ask not what you can, what the country can do for you, but what you can do for your country" statement by saying, "You should never ask the country to do something for you, and you should never do anything for the country that isn't in your narrow self-interest." And economists have these complicated models, which are all based on the assumptions that individuals will maximize their utility in market settings. That is, if you maximize your utility outside of a market, then it's inefficient because you don't know how much to do. So if you're praying and not paying, you don't know if you're praying enough because you need that price signal to tell you when you should stop praying and start doing something else. That's what all the models are designed to do. So if you look at that as your model, then your policy prescriptions are all going to be based on financial incentives. And then your analysis on cost and benefits will all be based on incomes, which is our measure of things, incomes and prices. Of course, very few people actually act this way on a regular basis. We have names for those. They are hedge fund managers and sociopaths. But we would never want our daughters to marry someone like that. We would never want to work with them in a firm. We'd never want to have them as neighbors. This is not how communities are held together. Most of us know, and Adam Smith knew this as well as Thomas Aquinas, that we have to look to the common good as a higher good, that we are part of a collective and our actions affect others, and the overall health of the community plays a major role in my success, and it's not just how well I can do. So inclusive institutions aim at making institutions so that most people can benefit, can participate. Exclusive ones are designed to limit others' participation. In many ways, it's a difference between wealth creation, creating more goods and services for everyone, and wealth capture, which is not trying to expand the pie, but just take a larger share for myself. Now, an example of what happens when you look at self-interest as your only criteria comes from a famous memo, which I'm sure many of you have seen, by Larry Summers. Larry Summers was the top economic advisor to Obama and was one of the three people responsible for deregulating the financial sector in the late 90s that gave us the crisis. I'm still waiting for my apology and refund. But Larry Summers, when he was at the World Bank, wrote a memo where he argued that high-polluting industries should all be moved from rich countries to poor countries. And the argument is the cost of the negative effects of pollution are measured in terms of foregone earnings from mortality and morbidity. So the only thing damaging about pollution is that someone's going to die and they'll not make any money, or they'll get sick and they'll make less money. That's the only damage, the only thing we're going to measure. And since the life expectancy, and since the incomes earned in poor countries are low, then the cost will be very low. And he also adds their life expectancy is low, and you know, usually it takes 20, 30 years to get cancer, so they'll probably die before the cancer. So we don't really have to worry about pollution if we move it to a low-wage country. And this is an exact quote. "I think the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to it." And this guy was the number two person at the World Bank when he wrote this. Now, luckily, the World Bank has had a huge transformation since then, but this is the attitude that we typically get from economic policy designers and advocates. But the economy doesn't run on that, and people do not make the decisions only on that. And as Benedict XVI pointed out in his last encyclical, the economy needs ethics in order to function correctly. And not any ethics, because self-interest is an ethics, but people-centered ethics. And that's what Catholic social thought brings to it. That it's not greed that holds the economy together. It's solidarity, ethics, and regulation. You know, enforcing laws, enforcing justice, in many ways enforcing legitimate property rights. Okay, so a people-centered ethics, and I'm sure many will recognize this, will ask different questions. It will not ask, well, how do we maximize gross domestic product without an analysis of what's counted and what isn't counted, but it will ask, what does the economy do for people? What does it do to people? And how do people participate in the economy? And this, of course, from Economic Justice for All. And it's because our understanding of the human person is different that we ask different questions and have different criteria for evaluating outcomes. If we use the rational economic man, or sometimes called homo economicus, well, then economics is fairly simple. And the decisions, the market will produce them as long as they're fair markets, which is a different issue altogether. But if we are interested in the whole person, then we have to just ask different questions and use different criteria to evaluate. And this is what Catholic social thought does. Catholic social thought is moral theology applied to economics and political issues. It's based on universal principles that we learn from Revelation, and lots of people have written on how you can, in the sacred scriptures, as well as the church fathers and the whole tradition, where we get these principles. But they've been formalized in the modern period with the various encyclicals, particularly as a reaction to capitalism, as the issues have changed dramatically, and as public policy became more a response to public issues. Now, if you have a dictatorship or a king or a form of government where people don't participate, then you don't have to engage public policy issues all that much because you don't have any say in the matter. But if you have countries where governments represent the people, well, then it's critical that you speak to those issues. Catholic social thought is not an alternative model. It's not the third way that was so popular in the late 90s between capitalism and socialism. Quite often, particularly when I'm working with social justice advocates, someone will say, you know, it'd be so nice, you know, the encyclicals are great if you can get through all the terminology, but, you know, they're just so general. You know, increase participation. Humans have dignity. But how do we implement that? Well, it would be good if they gave us advice on how to exactly do that. And, of course, these are the same people who say the Vatican should stop telling us what to do all the time. So there's a little irony there. But Catholic social thought, these are universal principles. These were true 1,000 years ago. They'll be true in 1,000 years. The economic problems and the economic issues and the economic institutions in 1,000 years will be fundamentally different than they are now, just as they were 1,000 years ago. You can't have one policy that fits all. In fact, one of the problems now in Washington is we have a group that are advocating what they call, you know, constitutional government and what the founding fathers wanted in terms of public policy. Well, the founding fathers didn't have many of the challenges that we now face. I mean, health care for the founding fathers was making sure you had enough leeches. Well, that'd be pretty easy to fund now. I mean, we wouldn't have to get rid of all the insurance companies. Fairly easy with that. You didn't have to worry about Social Security because, you know, not many people are going to live that long. And you didn't have to worry about education because you didn't have to know all that much. All you had to do was have a strong back and willingness to work. And when America needed to expand, we just stole more land from the Indians and then we could grow. It's a fairly easy model. But today, education is critical for our economic success. Healthcare is critical for our economic success. You know, so we just can't just say, well, we're only going to do what in the late 18th centuries a couple of people thought was what government should do. Governments are our representatives. They're not our enemy. And so they should be doing what the people want and not just what was written down 200 years ago. Okay, and Catholic social thought as I said, the tradition, the formal tradition starts with in 1891, but this goes way back. This is from a document that's known as the Teaching of the 12 Apostles, which in my copy says it was from the year 80 to 120. I've seen it dated up to 200, but most likely this was written by people who knew the apostles. And it's a fascinating document to read. It goes over the liturgy and basically is the first catechism manual for what it means to be a Christian. And in that, they lay out what is the way of life, and it's to love God, love your neighbor. Hasn't changed. And then what is the way of death? What are we to avoid? Now, it's got a long list. I only cut out the ones that are applicable for my speech today. One, thefts, idolatry, magical arts, sorcery, robberies, Wall Street, hypocrisy, duplicity, fraud, malice, covetousness, that is Wall Street. It's amazing how they understood that so early. The way of death is men that have no heart for the poor and are not concerned about the oppressed. And the way of death are murderers of children, destroyers of God's image, is the translation they gave of the Greek for abortion, which, again, our public policy agenda hasn't changed all that much since the year 80, because they're based on universal principles. How we can achieve these things, how you help the poor today, is fundamentally different than how you would help it in the year 80. But the necessity of helping the poor hasn't changed. Okay, and these are the principles. There are many lists. And a lot of what I've written in Catholic Social Thought is how these all have economic meaning. That is, how they can inform economists to better improve how the economy works. I'm not going to go into that. We'll be here forever. But the first one, the dignity of the human person, that is the critical one. Because when you start there and look at the person as made in the image of likeness of God, all your questions and what you find as acceptable outcomes change dramatically. And inclusive institutions flows from that, because as humans, we have to participate. We grow by working with others. Our happiness comes from giving ourselves to others. It is not an individual decision-making model. It is we have to be in community with others. And in the economy, we have ways that we can increase that, and we have ways that those with power will try to reduce that. Okay. So in Catholic Social Thought, we want to have evidence-based policy. Our goal is human flourishing. Means matter as much as ends. That is, how we achieve things is just as important as the ends towards which we're aiming for. We want to protect human dignity and promote the common good. For the last 3 years, we've been paralyzed. Washington's been paralyzed. It was almost impossible to get aid to help hurricane victims in New York and New Jersey. We figured the rest of the country would be afraid of New York and New Jersey. They've seen The Sopranos. They see how we'll get even. But still, they delayed it and delayed it. And part of it is an attempt to keep government from functioning by arguing things that should have been settled a long time ago. And one of these is the size of the government. The government is too big. Government is spending too much money. Often, when the president was giving proposals, the debate was between free markets and socialism. Barack Obama is a socialist. Yeah, most of my professors were like legitimate socialists. I mean, I know what a socialist is. I just wanted to do this, you know. Some of my best friends are socialists. Dude, Barack Obama is not a socialist. Barack Obama has given us some of the, the most moderate Republican policies the 1990s ever came up with. And all of a sudden that makes you a bomb-throwing socialist. I mean, it's just incredible. But if we're arguing that the government, it's not legitimate for the government to try to solve these problems, it's not a function of the government to provide health care for everyone, to get everyone above a minimum level, well, then the government will never be able to enact any policies. It won't get to the policy questions because it's still debating the whole issue of the legitimacy of the government being responsible for full employment, which is actually the law that the government's supposed to be responsible for full employment. So that... brings us to the second issue, and a lot of the stuff that I've written in Commonweal has been on the issue of the deficit, that we can't do anything because of the deficit. We can't help the poor because we don't have any money. This is the richest country in the world, and we can't help the poor because we don't have any money. You never have enough money to help the poor, if you ask a politician that. I was working for groups in Ireland in the 90s when unemployment was 18%, and they said, you know, we'd love to support your programs, but we don't have any money. Then we had the Celtic Tiger, unemployment's at 3%. The government is running surpluses so that they don't know what to do with the money. I was at a meeting where they were debating on how to spend more money because they couldn't figure out what to do with their surpluses. But so we said, well, here, the programs that you said you couldn't do when we were poor, now we can afford them. And, of course, they cut taxes instead. But, you know, so the way you maintain your power is through exclusive institutions preventing inclusive institutions. And policies designed to lift people out of poverty, policies designed to educate and give good health care, major causes of poverty, these are inclusive. And they will come up against your what you have now. And they come against your exclusive institutions. That the government was running out of money. The federal government can never run out of money. They pay their bills in their own currency. They can decide not to pay for things, but that's a political decision. But the federal government never doesn't have the money to pay for something. Now, it could be, if the economy is at full employment, if they try to buy something that everyone else is already buying, this will give us inflation. So when that happens, the government should raise taxes so we don't get inflation. That's a responsible thing to do. But if you are way under full employment, this is the economy, the red line is how the economy is doing, and the straight line is potential GDP. That's the level of output you want to have so that there are enough incomes to buy enough goods and services so that we have something near full employment, which is usually somewhere around 4.5%. And we could debate on that. But if you're on that line and the government wants to spend more money, well, then you have a legitimate reason to say, well, we should either cut spending somewhere else or raise taxes. Because the government's trying to buy something that someone's already buying, is trying to hire workers that already have jobs. That will bid up wages. That will cause inflation. However, we are well below that. The financial crisis brought us way down, and we're not getting back up. We're just running parallel. In fact, the top line is bending towards us. Every year, after a financial crisis, every year that you don't get back to full employment, the full employment level goes down by 1.5%. And it could take decades to get back to what would have been the original trajectory of potential output. The real problem we have is that this has become the new normal, that this is now where the economy is going to be, and that we just have to deal with the fact that we're going to have high unemployment for a very long time. We're going to have government will have a lot less revenue, won't be able to spend things because we are well below our potential output. If you are this far down, the government could easily spend another $1 trillion this year, and it wouldn't take a penny away from the private sector. The private sector is sitting on $1.9 trillion. They could just go out and spend it, and we'd get back to full employment. They're not spending it, and there are many theories on that. But the government, if the private sector isn't going to put the money in the economy, the government, straight Keynesian economics, everyone learns as a freshman, could spend the money and get us up to full employment. Then you start discussing trade-offs, whether we have more of something, less of something. But when you're in a state like we're in now, these arguments that it's going to cause inflation, that the bond interest rates will go up because the bond vigilantes will attack the United States. Well, the bond vigilantes attack other currencies by going into dollars. We have the world currency. I mean, this is it's inconceivable unless Congress says we're not going to raise the debt ceiling, we're going to stop paying our bills and start defaulting on our loans. And that would be a major catastrophe because the world is on a dollar standard, and that would be like being on a gold standard and finding out that all the gold is fake gold. I mean, this would be, we can't even think about what would happen. It could be that bad. So until we get up to that line, austerity is only going to, cutting spending is only going to make the new normal a permanent reality. Okay, so the real issues are, especially for Catholics and Christians, is poverty. Poverty is very high, and it is persistently high. Of course, the U.S. bishops noted that it's our, for Catholics, it's our single first priority. But even Adam Smith, who in 1776 wrote The Wealth of Nations and is the father of modern economics, noted that no society can be thought of as happy and flourishing if the poor, the people who produce the goods and services for society, if they're not also getting a fair share of that. And of course, the increase in poverty we'll see is greatly related to the increase in inequality. So just a couple of quick graphs on poverty. Well, but we basically know most of the statistics. Poverty, we've had some successes and some really glaring failures, but basically poverty has been between 11 and 15% since it came down dramatically from the late 50s until the mid-70s. So when they say that the policies of the Great Society didn't work, the war on poverty was a failure, well, cut it in half. So more than half for many groups. So I really don't think we could say that. And it was very successful, but it was incomplete. We had to keep on doing it until we got it down to where we would be similar to the other rich countries. The success we've had is in senior citizens for elderly poverty, which should be up there, which has come down and continues to come down. And that's because we deal with elderly poverty through a very inclusive set of institutions, Social Security and Medicare. And so everyone or almost everyone's included, and that's how you eliminate poverty, is that you have policies to ensure that people do have a real safety net. The big failure, particularly since the 1970s, has been for children poverty, which keeps on going up. It goes up and down, but has been persistently staying near the 20% range. And this could not be wise public policy to say, well, we're going to take one in five children and make sure that they have an inadequate resources so that when they become adults, they can fully participate and contribute to society. Why would you do that? Well, you would do that if you don't want them to actually have to compete with the other people. I mean, if you want to have a fair system with mobility, that means that those on the top will have less opportunities for their children and grandchildren to be at the top. If you look at the mobility statistics in the United States and Europe, you see it used to be the United States was the mobile society, whereas now we have the lowest mobility in the advanced capitalist world. The Europeans do so much better. Why do they do that? Everyone gets universal health care, and everyone gets as much education as their intelligence can bring. Well, those are the ladders, you know, education and health. I often say at the UN that stupid and sick is not a good development strategy. But so often, you know, the IMF goes in and says, well, you need to cut spending on health care and education. Now, again, I said we had a big turnaround in the World Bank. And so the World Bank is very supportive now of health care and education spending. And we have a change in leadership at the United Nations, at the IMF, so hopefully that will filter down. But I'm working with groups in Ireland who are fighting the IMF and their austerity programs now. Yet at the United Nations, the IMF readily says that austerity isn't working. Everyone has to change. Yet the people who are in charge of running Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain are still saying, well, except for you guys, you have to cut, 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 and cut. And, of course, Europe is in a prolonged recession because you can't cut your way into prosperity. Now, when we look at poverty and income inequality, they're usually explained with the same theory. First, poverty is because you don't have enough. The economic pie isn't big enough. But that argument... And that argument gives you the first policy response. Well, if we just promote enough growth, it will trickle down. Conservative economists will say that poverty is because of individual choices. Now, they don't say that because they're mean. Everything is explained by individual choices. you know, global warming. Well, individuals are making the wrong choices. That's why we're having global warming. And all we can do is get people to make different choices. Cancer is probably caused by individual choices. Everything in their model has to be explained by individual choices. So when they look at poverty, they only look at things that individuals either can choose, or sometimes they'll include proxies, but even then, such as belonging to a labor union, things like that, but it still can't be part a major part of their explanatory model. Whereas liberal economists look at structures and institutions and look at poverty as being explained through that. So if you are explaining things as an individual outcome, then you will use things like, you will have policies like welfare reform, which was designed to give incentives so that people made different choices. If you looked at it structurally, well, then you would have things like Social Security or the Earned Income Tax Credit or, which we should have, a child benefit plan that all the other rich countries have, so that every child born is given a minimum amount of income so that they don't have to live in extreme poverty. And in reality, poverty, of course, is explained through both. You know, people do make bad decisions. You know, if I become an alcoholic, eventually, although I'm a tenured professor, so maybe not, but eventually my employer would figure out that I'm not doing a good job and that this will lead to me losing my job and then being out on the streets and losing my family. And, you know, these are not good choices. But we don't make choices looking at the same menu. We don't have all of the same options. And the choices that the poor face are a very different menu than middle-class people. And the mistakes they make last, the effects last for a very long time, whereas the mistakes that teenage wealthy white children make, those are easily papered over. Well, we'll get community service or something. It will not have a lasting effect that being incarcerated would have, which will mean you will earn a lot less your whole life. You will have a better chance of, you know, being killed by a terrorist, that's a bad analogy to use, but the escaping poverty. It won't be that bad, but it will be pretty close to very small percentage of people will be able to make that leap once they have that label attached to them, which will follow them forever. That's a way to exclude people rather than trying to build institutions that bring people in. And, of course, the other, well, let's, if we, the other slide I had was on, by race, on poverty. And that's another example that of exclusive institutions and how outcomes are determined not by individual choices alone. Okay, this graph, which only an economist could like, but this graph looks at poverty rates predicted and actual. And it's based on a simple model that uses macroeconomic statistics like economic growth and employment to predict the poverty rate. And it's basically to show how much economic growth affects poverty. So if the economy slows down, we expect poverty to go up. If it speeds up, we expect to go down. And the model is, works perfectly, or near perfect for an economic model, until around 1980. And then we see after 1980, the pinkish line, that's what the poverty rate should have been if we had the same institutions, the same rules, the same policies in the 80s that we had in the 70s, if we continued those relationships. For a long time, economists were fighting this, but now I think every economist accepts economic growth is not filtering down to the poor. I mean, the type of economic growth you need to have in order to bring everyone along is unsustainable and unrealistic. I mean, we started to have success when we had this huge bubble economy, which clearly was not sustainable. So that it's only if we all just act completely irrational and borrow lots of money and spend it all that we will start to have money filtering down to the bottom. And this is not an effective way of reducing poverty. And it doesn't last and eventually crashes and then everyone else becomes poor. But this is one of my favorite graphs. And I'm probably the only one in the room who has a favorite graph. But what this graph does, and it's a lot of information, but there's two lines, there's red and blue lines. The red line is what is the poverty rate that the market produces in different countries? And these are all the advanced capitalist countries. So, and markets will markets should give different incomes because prices, wages are signals. If we have a shortage of one group, we want their wages to go up so more people get those skills. That's how markets are supposed to work. But you can see, after you let the market signal and coordinate, you can then redistribute through public policy to dramatically to reduce poverty. So the market poverty rate for Sweden is higher than the United States. So the Swedish economy by itself will produce more poverty than the United States economy will produce, which, you know, is just mind-numbing when you think about that. Yet, then they, through their tax and spending and benefit programs, bring down their poverty rates to very low rates, about 5-6%. In fact, the United States market poverty is just a little under the average for all the countries. So we basically, our wage system, especially if you take out the financial sector, isn't that bad. But we don't do anything to support the people at the bottom with various forms of benefits so that they can fully participate, such as for food, health, education, housing, etc. We do much, much less of that, so that our, in the end, our poverty rate, using the, these are all using the same measure of poverty, so it's not the official measure that the U.S. government uses, but it ends up at 17%. This is before the financial crisis, these statistics. But all these are advanced capitalist countries. They all have as much economic freedom as the United States. They have as much democracy as the United States. They've made choices to have lower levels of poverty. They've decided, well, everyone here is a citizen, so we want to all have at least a minimal level. It's not that the communists took over these countries. They have private sectors. Most businesses are owned privately. You know, it's just that they've taken part of it, the economy, and said, well, we're going to share this equally because that's the type of society we want. And we've just decided not to do that. Here, quote from Benedict, from the Pope, again, brings it back to our understanding of the that the dignity of the human person, and that the human person, if we exclude, we're attacking their dignity, and this is, he's arguing, is the cause of poverty. And income inequality is the flip side of poverty. In fact, you cannot lower poverty without lowering income inequality. And the causes, much of the cause of the big increase in income inequality in the United States in the past 30 years has been in really two small sectors, the financial sector and CEOs, CEO pay, which has exploded. But if you take them out, then our income increase in inequality is not much different than many of the other countries, which has been a slight increase, not dramatic. And we could explain that relatively easy by the importance of more education because of a high-tech economy, and the people who have those credentials are going to do better until enough people catch up and we fully educate everyone, and then we'll have more equality. In the long run, markets should move incomes. Income should start to converge based on how much education and experience you have. In the short run, when you have a tech revolution, those who have those abilities and credentials will do relatively well. So we expect a little wage inequality, but nothing compared to what we've had in the United States. And it's mostly because we changed the rules in the 1980s, cut out support for workers, particularly for unions, but generally there was a dramatic reduction for the middle and down. And we changed the rules to allow the financial sector to expand its activities in the economy, particularly the speculative aspect. Wall Street. Not all finance is Wall Street. We used to, give you an example, we used to finance our housing by going to a bank which collected people's deposits. They lent it out, and for 30 years you paid it off to the bank, and the money they got was then lent to other people who would buy houses. A very sustainable, community-supported process. Wall Street had nothing to do with it. Wall Street decided, well, we want to get a piece of this action. They start to securitize and buy all these mortgages from the banks. Now, this allowed them to increase the number of mortgages, but to increase it to a level where we were lending to people who couldn't afford the mortgages. So that certainly didn't work out. But what it did mean is that a share of what was excluded from this sector is now income for that sector. So if we get money to go through Wall Street, they can take a big cut of it before it goes to where it effectively needs to go, lending to people so they can buy a house or build a house, et cetera. Same thing has happened with healthcare. There's no reason for healthcare to have any connection to Wall Street. Healthcare is taking care of sick people. We have a very good idea how many people are going to be sick this year. It wouldn't be that hard to allocate resources to make sure we can take care of those people and to allocate resources to try to prevent some of those diseases. But if you run it through a private insurance industry, through Wall Street, then it's being run for how do you maximize the share that goes to the people who are running the financing aspect of this. This is known as money manager capitalism, where the economy is run for the benefit of this one sector. Finance has doubled in size as a share of GDP in the past 30 years. Before the crash, finance took 40% of all corporate profits. Now, the purpose of corporate profits is for corporations to, A, pay dividends, but also to reinvest in the economy, do something productive. Well, Wall Street doesn't have to reinvest in the economy. They're not building factories or investing in a way that's going to create any jobs. They'll just speculate more and pay out higher bonuses. So the larger their share gets, the less efficient the economy gets, the less stable. Before we made all these changes that allowed this, we had one financial crisis from the end of World War II to 1980 in England. And if I remember the English, I think sex was involved, but I'm not sure. But in the 60s, they had a... that was a different crisis. In 74, they had a banking crisis. There were no other ones in the rich countries. After 1980, the average country has had 19 years of living under financial crises. You know, we have more financial crises than we have Olympics and World Cups combined. This is part of the model. And the great irony is that all this financial deregulation was designed to make markets more stable because the economists had said we can price risk so it won't exist. If you can correctly price risk, you get away from, you eliminate the risk. And so all these derivatives, all this was designed so that we wouldn't have big variations in asset prices. And of course, they've done nothing but give us variations in asset prices. But of course, when you make money when it goes up and you make money when it goes down, variations is exactly what you need. So it serves their interests perfectly. And if occasionally they slip up and go bankrupt, and all of them should have went bankrupt in 2008, we bailed them out. Well, knowing that the government's going to bail them out, well, that's a small price to pay. You know, because they were the reason why Lehman Brothers was such a shock is that someone actually said no. But they're not going to say no again. Okay, so income inequality is created by creating exclusive institutions, making it harder for others to participate at the higher paying jobs because it's harder for them to get education, et cetera, and by exclusive rules where money's going through your part of the economy instead of going directly from savers to investors who are building businesses. It's creating another level that has to take a share, and they take a very large share. So income inequality is a major cause of financial crises and unemployment. And this is something that John Maynard Keynes in the 30s pointed out. If all the money is going to the top, they're going to spend less money that will go to buying goods and services that employ us. Now, this is one of the things that Paul Krugman argued against. He said, no, the rich can buy enough yachts to employ us. Well, again, if he had read his economic history, he would know that Thomas Robert Malthus argued the same point. The rich need to hire more servants in order to absorb the surplus population. So if we have a Downton Abbey policy for full employment, just give the rich more money and convince them they all need butlers. But the fact of the matter is that they're not going to employ a lot of people because they're not going to buy 8 and 9 yachts. They're not buying enough of the goods and services that average people make that employ average people. The Great Depression was caused by the big increase in inequality in the 1920s. We have the exact same thing happening here. You have to have money. Money is the blood of the economy. It has to flow continuously back into the economy. It cannot be hoarded up in any particular area and stay there. That brings the whole economy down. It's like having a blood clot affecting your overall health. And as I mentioned, right now, large corporations are sitting on $1.9 trillion. That is making the whole economy unhealthy because the economy is designed for money to continue to flow around. So you have to have policies that encourage inclusivity to bring inequality down, and that will bring poverty down at the same time. But that will necessarily mean that the share that has gone to the top, and most of their increase in wealth, you know, it's pointed out that the rich top 1% have captured like 90% of the economic growth over the last 10 years. But they've actually captured much more than the economic growth. If you look at the world economy from 1997 to 2007, the world economy grew by 49%, world output. But the incomes of the elite rich grew by 109%. So it grew at twice the rate. So they're not only capturing the growth, they're taking away from the share that the rest of the population has. As I said, this is an example of wealth capture instead of wealth creation. Like, if I could enslave everyone in this room, the wealth of this room would go up dramatically. Because right now, you know, your individual personhood is not an element of wealth. You know, on your balance sheet, you don't list yourself worth $50 or whatever, or $5 million, depending on your ego. Whereas if I own you, now you're on someone's balance sheet and wealth will increase. You know, at the time of the Civil War, many communities in the South, 40% of the wealth were persons, were slaves. So there are many ways you can increase wealth that actually decrease the well-being of the community. There are also many ways to increase wealth that increases the well-being of the community. And that's the whole idea of how markets are supposed to operate. We're supposed to reward people who make goods and services that we like. But we're also supposed to have openings so that other people can say, oh, Joe over there is having success doing this. I'm going to try that. Instead, after I've had success, I spend much of my money making sure no one else can emulate my success. I mean, Apple got a design patent on a square with rounded edges. Steve Jobs just drew a little box with rounded edges, and they're preventing other phone manufacturers from making phones that have rounded edges as an invasion of their patent. This is going to stifle innovation. It's going to stifle economic growth and technological change. This is using an exclusive institution as a barrier to other people becoming successful. You know, a free market, this is the exact opposite of what a free market is supposed to do. A free market is supposed to allow as many people in, and then your abilities will determine what you get. And as soon as you're very successful, other people will learn from you, do what you do. Your income will start to go down, theirs will go up. In the long run, we'll have a great deal of equality. If you have inclusive institutions, this is how it will happen. And if you look at the on the world scale stage, in terms of global development, global poverty, and inequality, it's the exact same issue. That global poverty is mostly explained by exclusive institutions. And some of these exclusive institutions are clearly created by and enforced by the elites, the dictators, the people in charge, who are using their position to reward all their friends. I teach a development course with mostly development workers as students, and I asked them in the beginning to list what are the 10 biggest barriers in your country that you're working on. 99 times out of 100, it's corruption. Well, that corruption only exists because you have exclusive institutions that are designed to keep their share, even though they know and everyone else knows, them keeping their share, the exclusive institutions, are the barrier for the whole country improving. Inclusive institutions will, by necessity, bring down the top. And if your purpose in politics is to put yourself and your friends at the top, the last thing you're going to allow to happen is for inclusive institutions to transform your society and make it internationally competitive and allow your people to use their talents and energies to improve their lives. So, and, you know, there's no shortage of examples of, you know, just reading a book that used North Korea, compares North Korea and South Korea as the example over and over. There's no shortage of examples of countries like North Korea that will use their wealth to keep the population from developing because their power is based on their poverty. You know, famine is a way of social control. But this is done internationally as well. A lot of the international institutions are designed to protect the rights and the position of the rich countries against the poor countries. The World Trade Organization is a good example of this, and the poor countries eventually, to their credit, walked out of the negotiations. Because one of the things that the rich countries insist on doing is subsidizing their agriculture that makes it impossible for African farmers to compete on an international scale. I mean, I often say in face-to-face, not officially, when I'm at the UN, you know, what the rich countries should do is stop doing bad things. We can come up with some good things they can do, but I'm more interested in getting them to stop doing the harmful things that are become barriers to their development. And so having an agricultural policy that leads to overproduction of certain crops in the West that then get given away or dumped on markets in the third world, preventing third world farmers from earning a decent return, being able to have viable businesses that they can reinvest and do all the things that you want in a development of a market economy. And this happens over and over. We also have a problem in which there's so much of the wealth in poor countries that goes to be spent and invested in rich countries. I was at we were working on language for a bill at the United Nations, and the United States, the European Union, and Japan were all picking on the African countries for all the illicit money that's leaving the country. So they were worried that the money from gun running and drugs was leaving Africa. They wanted to stay in Africa to reinvest in Africa, I guess. They weren't worried about the guns and the drugs. They were worried about the money leaving. And the Africans pointed out, well, you have the same problem of the illegal activities. And I'm sitting there thinking, it's the legal money that's leaving Africa that's a problem. Africa produces a lot of wealth. Africa lends money to the United States so Americans can spend more than they earn. There has to be at least some projects in Africa that could be developed on that are a little more important than teenagers buying another Nike shirt. I mean, there's so much need down there, but the wealth, it leaves Africa so quickly and doesn't get reinvested. If you could just get them to have control over their resources and the wealth that's generated in there, you'll have more of a powerful impact on Africa than anything else you could do, I am convinced. Now, a lot of the rich countries got rich by creating barriers to the poor countries or exclusive institutions like stealing minerals, enslaving populations, etc. So the West owes those areas for all their subsidies to our development. So I'm fully in favor of foreign aid and that it should be well-directed foreign aid. But before we talk about that, we should stop doing things that are harmful to the development of the poor in the poorest areas of the world. That should do no harm should be our first motto. Now, my last slide is always my last slide, and I'm going to end here, and I'm going to try to remember it. But it's a quote from St. John Chrysostom. I get a lot of inspiration from the Church Fathers, and he's my favorite by far. And he writes that as Christians, and I really think this speaks to any time you're a Christian in a pagan society, but when we live according to the moral principles of our faith, those around us will respond in three ways. They may be so impressed by our example of goodness and so envious of the joy which it brings that they will want to join us and become like us. And this is what we want. The second would be indifference, because they are so bound up by their selfish cares and concerns, although their eyes may perceive our way of life, because they are so bound up by their selfish cares, I'm repeating myself, their hearts are blind, so they are unable to stir them. Third, they may react against us. feeling threatened by our example and even angry with us. Thus, they will cling even more firmly to their material possessions and selfish ambition and slander us in every opportunity. I didn't know the New York Times was writing in the 4th century, but I guess it was. Naturally, we dread this third type of reaction because we want to live in peace with our neighbors, regardless of their personal beliefs and values. And here's my favorite part. But if no one reacts to us in this way, we must wonder whether we are truly fulfilling the commandments of Christ. Thank you very much.